Where'd this come from?
Okay. Regular meeting, the Amador County Board of Supervisors will come to order. The board has met in closed session and just heard a report and had discussion on item 1A, conference with real property negotiators. This involves the Edwin Lands County negotiators, Charles Eiley and John Hopkins. And with that, can you all stand and join me in the pledge, please?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible.
Thank you. And with that, I want to make a note. Supervisor Plaz is decided to take a week off, so he is on vacation this week. And with that, can we have approval of the agenda?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Novelli, second by Supervisor Boitano. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries 401. Public matters not on the agenda. Discussion items only. No action to be taken. Any person may address the board at this time upon any subject within the jurisdiction of the Amador County Board of Supervisors. However, any matter that requires action may be referred to staff under committee for report and recommendation for possible action at a subsequent board meeting. There is a 3-minute time limit per person. And is there any public comment at this time? Yes, sir. Eldon.
Morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Mr. Boitano, I left that for Mr. Plaz.
I see that.
Could you give it to him?
I'll make sure he gets it.
Okay. Yeah, we're fighting over it up here.
After I read it, though.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Dave Richards, and representing the Motherlode Shrine Club. Well, I came today to thank you for the use of your social services building on April the 27th, Saturday. We held a screening clinic there for young people to be admitted into our hospital in Sacramento. We had 7 young people qualified for admission to the hospital. And in order to get into our hospital, you have to be referred by a doctor. And Dr. Hartman came again this year and donated his time for these 7 people. And I've told you before about our hospital. It doesn't cost the parents any money at all. But do you have any other questions that I could answer?
No, it's a great thing, though. It really is.
Well, thank you very much for the use of your hospital and Dr. Hartman.
Well, thank you.
Any other public comment? Morning, Kimberly.
Good morning. Kimberly Pruitt with Representative McClintock's office. Just want to let you know that I'll be here today doing constituent office hours upstairs, and want to thank you for letting us use the facility for that. And I wanted to give you an update on the Yosemite, the MRSED plan and the Yosemite issues that I spoke about last month. There will be an official field hearing, congressional field hearing, with the Natural Resources Committee in July. I'll get back to you on the date with that. It'll either be the first or the second week of July, and they are going to be doing it in the park down at Yosemite, so more details to come on that. And the last time we spoke, the congressman had spoken out about extending the comment period for the to the Park Service, and they did extend it 12 days. We got hundreds and hundreds of comments back to our office, and so that's why we're doing the field hearing in July. And I just wanted to let you know about that.
And I know it impacts the park. The greatest impacts are to the park, what they're trying to do, but it seems like that's not a very good time to have it, since that's right at the height of tourist season in the park itself.
Exactly. What they're trying to do, is the reason they want to do it in the beginning of July, is because they're supposed to come out with their final decision, record of decision, towards the end of July. and they're hoping that this will help put a little bit more public pressure on the Park Service to listen and keep some of those amenities in place.
You know, a question, Ms. Pruitt, as far as the actions they're taking there, what is the driver? Is it, are they doing it under the wild and scenic, I guess, provisions put in place to keep due to that, or is it, or are they just doing like a general rework of the park? What would be kind of your general opinion on that?
Well, the federal opinion of the judge was to give it back to the Park Service to come up with a plan, and it is part of the wild and scenic.
So that's the driving factors of wild and scenic designation and the ramifications from that?
Right. And so the Park Service, it was given to them to come up with a specific plan to mitigate some of the potential factors they say that would be harming the Merced. And but their answer was to take out pretty much every commercial, almost all the commercial activity in the park, including raft rentals, horseback riding, bike rentals, a historic bridge, swimming pools, an ice skating rink, a couple of the lodges. It's pretty extensive and would really hurt the tourism there in the park.
Would you say the main reason for doing that would be that being designated wild and scenic, the Merced River? Is that the...
That's part of it. That's part of it, definitely. Any wild and scenic designation can put severe restrictions on areas, but the National Park Service has a mandate to keep that open to the public to enjoy, and so there's a balance there. They kind of went all one way, and we're trying to get them to come back somewhere towards the middle. And so that's kind of where we're at with the having the hearing in July to help with the outcome of hoping that the public pressure will help the outcome be more balanced.
Well, I personally appreciate staff's efforts on that and the congressman's, and thank you.
Thank you. And we will have our tomorrow our Sierra Forest Action Coalition congressional forum, and so I'll see you there.
Yeah, I'll be there.
Kimberly, I'm concerned about the where are you going to have it within the park for that many people, though, and it could turn into a major disaster similar to the AB 885 hearings where they expected 100 people and had 400 people show up.
I'm not sure. Right now they're still trying to decide where they're going to be able to have it, and they may have to limit it because of the size. So I know that they're talking about that being a difficult time of the year to have it there. But at the same time, strategically, it's kind of the best time to have it there because that's when most of the tourists are there enjoying those amenities. So it's just up to the Park Service and the Congressional Committee to decide. So right now they're trying to decide on the location.
Maybe they want to be able to show them firsthand how people enjoy all those amenities. That's probably part of it. You know, if they take a lot of that stuff out, it seems to me it makes it harder for people to enjoy the park because not everybody is the same level of, you know, their physics and moving around and it's, you know, handicap, on and on and on. So the beauty of it is right now almost people from all walks of life can come in there and enjoy it.
Exactly. And there are a lot of issues with the traffic and things like that you know, that they're working on down there. So, you know, there's other ways of fixing the problem rather than getting rid of all the commercial activity.
Big problem, too, is there's, you know, all the national parks understaffed because of sequestered. So it's a really big problem.
Kimberly, thank you for keeping us informed on this. One question, if people wanted to send letters on this, should they send them directly to the congressman?
Yeah, you can send them directly to our office. If you go to our website, mcclintock.house.gov, you can email them directly to the office. The congressman's on the public lands subcommittee, so all of the comments that we're receiving are going to the resources committee, and they're keeping those, and all the districts around us are doing the same. So that way they can have a record of how many are coming in and what people are saying.
Kimberly, I just want to say we appreciate what the congressman and what staff's doing to try to keep our parks open. As you know, there are agencies out there right now that are trying to not take, but trying to put regulations on more and more properties throughout the counties in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and it's going to be detrimental to the people in our counties and to the people in the other counties, like Tuolumne, like Mariposa, those counties, et cetera. So we appreciate what the congressman and his staff is doing. And also, too, I want to let you know that we've been telling people in this county that you're here on the last Tuesday of the month, so you might have some visitors today. So
great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Any other public comments? All right, well, then we'll move on to the consent agenda.
Mr. Chairman, on the consent agenda, I'd like to have one item pulled until we could find out. And I talked with Supervisor Plaz about this issue in regards to it would be underneath agreements. It'd be 4C. And maybe the undersheriff by the end of the day or the sheriff or one of their representatives could come by and I could ask some questions in regard to this.
What specific questions, sir?
Well, we want to know if this just pertains to substance investigation and anything else, or if there are other things behind the scenes that are different than substance investigations. Supervisor Plaz and I last week met with USFS, and we had some concerns about patrols our sheriff's office would be doing in their jurisdictions.
Okay. We'll take that off of the consent agenda then and either handle it later or at the next meeting. So with that item excluded, can I have a motion?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
Any discussion?
Moved by Supervisor Novelli, second by Supervisor Onetto to approve the consent agenda with item 4C pulled off.
Thank you, sir.
Any further discussion?
Yeah, when we have a surveying and engineering approval of a resolution approving two certificates of compliance, we get APN numbers for those in the future, because I have property contiguous with Waters and Ranch. I know this is probably not there, but it'd be nice so I could look, and because of the holiday, I couldn't look.
If you want to pull it with that concern? Or
no, I'll just step down just to be safe. But you see my point.
So, do you need to step down on that item then?
I don't know. I didn't have a chance to look.
We can do that. We automatically look them up. And you know, we didn't get it in the notice, but we can put it on the face of the ATF if that would help.
That would be very helpful. Actually, I've had this several times before in the past, so yeah, it would.
Right.
Council, should Supervisor Boitano step down on that vote then?
Unless you know.
Stay.
Well, if you're not going to vote, then you need to recuse yourself. And
he's not sure if he should vote or not. He's not sure if he has a conflict.
This is off of Greenwich Road.
Then I don't have a conflict.
On Sacramento.
Okay. I don't have a conflict then.
Okay. All right. So we have a motion and a second to approve the consent agenda with item 4C polled. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. And on to our regular agenda. Item 6, presentation of a resolution honoring Mr. Russell Robert Tonzi on the occasion of his 100th birthday. And even though Mr. Tonzi is in my district, Supervisor Novelli has a more intimate relationship with him, so he's going to make the presentation of the resolution.
Thank you. I got a resolution here for you from the Board of Supervisors. Resolution number 13044, resolution honoring Mr. Russell Robert Tonzi on the occasion of his 100th birthday. So congratulations on that right off the bat. read it. Whereas Russell Robert Tonzi was born in Mount Echo, California on May 4th, 1913, in the family home on Tonzi Road. Whereas Russell's grandfather, Giuseppe Tonzi, and his grandmother, Rosa Tonzi, immigrated from Ticino, the Italian canton of Switzerland, in 1874, settling on 160 acres on what is now called Tonzi Road. And whereas Russell's father, John, a character member of Amador El Dorado Sacramento Cattlemen's Association, drove a freight wagon pulled by horses and mules delivering supplies to the Amador County mines and to the Chickasola store. He later purchased 1,400-plus-acre ranch to raise cattle located Irish Hill Road, where Russell still lives to today. Russell and his brother and sister attended school in Carbondale and Ione, traveling to school in a horse and buggy, and he worked on a ranch and remember cutting and hauling hay with horses for $25 a ton. Whereas Russell drove a Model T Ford to school, Sutter Creek High School, where he learned to build and repair engines that gave him a great start in a long career. Skilled mechanic, he worked on the gold dredge on Dry Creek in the 1930s. Whereas Russell and his wife, Wilma, were married in Reno in 1932. After the ceremony, they returned home and went to the Cattlemen's Ball in Plymouth and danced until midnight hours. They were married for 57 years upon her passing in 1989. They have two children, a daughter, Gloria, and a son, James. Whereas Russell is asked if there is a secret to his longevity, I don't smoke, I eat right, and I try to keep active. I take a seaweed tablet every day, and I don't eat a lot of sugar. And three or four times a week, I have a drink of good old Canadian Mist. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors of the County of Amador, State of California, does hereby honor Russell Robert Tonzi on his 100th birthday, May 4th, 2013, and is thankful for his long life contributions to Amador County. Congratulations, Russell. Grazie, Council. Grazie, huh? Grazie, Council. All right, there you go. All right, they want to take your picture over here. I think they want to hold. Take your picture. You can talk. You can talk in here, Russell. If you want
to. I want to say this is a pretty long road to get here. This plaque is worth a lifetime to me. Everything in there is true. It happened. I guess I didn't know we were going to be presented with this. My great friend Karen come up close to it, telling you what to do for me. I appreciate this plaque. I have to make a museum room now. I got another nice plaque that Greg Biskey made me, the Iron Man that sits on there, and he put a lot of work in it. Jesus, you have to see it. I thank you a million. I know what more to say. I don't want to talk too long about the situation.
Thank you very much.
Every day,
Chio.
Yeah.
Help him out there, kid.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Tonzi, I would invite you to stay for the rest of the meeting, but you might be 101 before we end, so.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You know, when we started the meeting, we walked in, I was looking around for the 100-year-old man. Didn't realize it was him.
I know. He looks good.
Start drinking some of that.
All right. We'll move on now to our second item, item 7, Kirkwood Out Valley Electric Project. All right, Kirkwood Out Valley Electric Project discussion and possible action relative to an update by Kirkwood Public Utility District regarding the subject project.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have Mr. Michael Sharp here. He's representing Kirkwood KPUD in regards to the bringing power into Kirkwood after these many, many years. Michael, come on up.
My name is Michael Sharp. I'm the general manager of the Kirkwood Meadows Public Utility District. I have worked in Kirkwood for over 25 years. I'd like to thank the chair and Supervisor Novelli for having me here today. The Kirkwood PUD, is, which we refer to the district, was formed by LAFCO action in 1985 and has grown to provide most of the utility services in Kirkwood for the community. Community, including water, wastewater, electricity, propane, fire service, solid waste, and snow removal. Electricity in Kirkwood comes from the use of diesel-fired generators, which are the cleanest in the environment, but they're still diesel-fired generators. This configuration requires the transport of diesel up Scenic Corridor Highway 88. The risk of an environmental disaster should an accident occur has given many pause, including the community of Kirkwood, United States Forest Service, and many residents of Amador County. For years, the Kirkwood Ski Resort and the district have looked at ways to bring power in from the national grid, whether that be from South Lake Tahoe, through Strawberry, from Douglas County, or up through Amador. Efforts started and then fizzled out, mostly due to the cost. Then on January 1st of 2010, a fire destroyed the existing electric powerhouse, resulting in the sale of the ski resort's electric and propane divisions to the district. The district built a new powerhouse, 5-megawatt powerhouse, which went into operation in March of 2012. We began work on an electric line to connect the district to the national grid via Salt Springs. After many years of research studies, plans, designs, and more meetings than I ever thought would be possible, the district will begin construction on this $30 million project in early June. The environmentals are complete and approved. The financing, a loan through the government, Rural Utility Services, has been established. The design has been completed. The construction team has been selected, and the permitting is nearly complete. An underground contractor, Q&D out of Sparks, Nevada, has been selected. The first area of construction will be in Kirkwood itself, from Highway 88 to the new powerhouse. Then, dependent on the delivery of cable, the contractor will move to direct bury sections along Highway 88 on U.S. Forest Service property. Work on Bear River Road will be started after the Labor Day holiday, commencing around September 9th. The underground portion of this project is anticipated to take 2 years, or two building seasons, to complete, with the conduit and most of the direct buried sections done in 2013, and the pulling of the cable and the balance of the installation scheduled for 2014. The overhead portion of the project will go out to bid in July, and the substation work will be completed in 2014. In November 2014, the district hopes to invite all of you to an energizing party at Kirkwood. Thanks again for taking the time, and I will take any questions if you have those.
Questions, board members? I have a question for you on the environmental part of this. As you're doing the underground work going up Highway 88, are there going to be junction boxes or potential connection areas for other properties going up 88? Or is this project solely for Kirkwood?
Solely for Kirkwood.
Why were there not any means made for connections for other properties that may want to or might want to connect to into the power source?
The system was designed for the capacity use of Kirkwood, and Kirkwood, of course, is the entity that's funding this project. So we designed the power line to meet our ultimate capacity needs.
Well, I'm looking at down the road. If there are people that want to connect between lower part of the county and Kirkwood, it would be nice to allow them to connect in. So it's not sized then for anyone else to connect if they want to, or do they even have the opportunity to connect to it?
At this point, it's not. It is sized for our ultimate build-out, and we're, of course, funding the entire, project. During the process of the environmental, we actually have looked at it and actually have not really had many takers or people that, wanted to come forward and help fund this $30 million project. This is a huge project, and with our rate base of 700 customers, it's extremely expensive.
So it's not so much an issue of environmental restrictions as it is more cost restrictions for people that did not want to come up with the funds to contribute to upsize the capacity?
I would think that's a true statement.
Part of the problem, though, too, wasn't in the environmental comment that it was growth-inducing to make it bigger, and so then it was thought to be wiser to size it for the project itself.
Michael, also, too, for us to, once you do get the power up to the powerhouse in Kirkwood, for someone to take the power off that power line, we would have to have some kind of a reducer somewhere, right, to bring that power if we were to take the power right off that line?
Well, it gets very complicated.
You just couldn't hook up a tee off that line and run it into, say, one of the Caltrans entities or into Silver Lake. You need some kind of a reducer or bring it back to your powerhouse in Kirkwood and then have a reducer there and feed it back to wherever you want it to feed it, correct? You just couldn't.
Yeah, it's a 34K line.
Yeah.
And you'd have to step down that power to provide for residential or commercial. And then you get into the problem that area, the corridor, is actually a PG&E corridor. PG&E is not in Kirkwood, so they would have to obtain the right from PG&E to get power from that line. Also, they'd have to do their own environmental. And we went through and did our environmental at a huge cost and got it passed and approved. So there is quite a few complications.
Let me ask this question, since it's sized for the project itself, but is the conduit oversized for future? Or is it sized for the line that's in it? There's going to be in it.
Very good question. The board decided that we would not put the entire line in conduit from because of cost considerations and also the technology that has come about through direct buried cable. So right now, portions of the line are in direct bury and portions of the line are in conduit. Wherever it's in a right-of-way, Bear River Road, Caltrans right-of-way, it's in conduit in those sections. But on the United States Forest Service, where it's off into the boonies, per se, it's a direct buried line.
Yeah. A question. You said you have all your environmental work done, so it probably won't be a factor, but they're looking at naming some areas yellow-legged frog habitat. Do you see that having any effect on you, or are you already across that bridge?
Already cross that bridge. The only area that we have a limited operating area is the spotted owl, which is near the Bear River Resort. Limited area that we can only construct during August 15th.
On the Bear River area across the dam, we're having poles, right? Those big 85-foot poles that bring the power down.
Yeah, so at the other side of the road that swings around Bear Valley, then it goes to Overhead, and there's a 34K line that goes 1.3 miles to what we call was a substation in the there, and then it does the transformation from 34K up to 115, and that goes down to the Salt Springs where we connect with PG&E.
Not an impossibility then in the future if a group of people got together and wanted to try and get a connection. They would obviously they'd have to go through the getting the right equipment installed to modulate the power down, but it's not an impossibility. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
It's Supervisor Patino, it couldn't be growth inducing, so it would have to be an existing customer. They'd have to do their own environmental. They'd have to work out the service territory with PG&E, and then they would have to pay for all the costs to step down that power to meet their needs. And then they'd have to prove that the needs of their needs would be less than what we need for capacity coming up the mountain. So there's quite a few hurdles. Impossibility.
Cost prohibitive.
Cost prohibitive.
In all practicality, probably is. Okay, any other board questions? Any public comments or questions? All right, Mr. Sharp,
thank
you very much for being here today.
We look forward to getting energized up at Kirkwood.
There you go. We'll have a ceremony. I'll be coming down on a quarterly basis to update you on the progression. And if you have any questions along the way, Supervisor Invaldi knows how to talk, contact me, and I look forward to
if you have a big map at some point to show the progress, where you're making progress, that might be helpful.
Yeah, and I'll bring that down in my next update.
Great.
We have a map right now up at the board office on a wall, but I don't have any of the progress report, but it is a huge map. Maybe if you bring anything down, we can update that map.
Perfect. I'll do that on a regular basis.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for taking
the time. Thank you.
All right. We'll go on to item 8, Community Development Agency discussion and possible action relative to establishment of evaluation criteria for design of the Shenandoah Road at Fiddledown Road intersection.
Hello, nice to see you again. Rebecca Nealon with Dockin Engineering. So staff has been working on the workshop format for next week, and we've certainly refine the alternatives, and we don't have this option, but we want to add these pieces, but we don't know exactly how much it's going to cost. That's been cleared up. But I think the other element of the presentation that really needs to be a little more solid is we show up with these alternatives, we throw them up on the wall, and we just invite the public to come up here and talk nonstop about what they like and don't like about the alternatives. So one thing we think can help get the public and the board to a decision point is to show up with this alternatives comparison matrix. And I think you guys have a copy in your packet? Okay.
Well, not only thing we have this time.
Does it look like this?
Yep.
Yep. Okay. So the intention
doesn't tell me a whole lot.
Huh?
Doesn't tell me a whole lot.
I'll tell you all about it.
Okay.
So the intention of this alternatives comparison table is to put the public's comments and the board's comments on the left-hand side as alternative comparison criteria for here's what we want our preferred alternative to do. We want it to reduce speed, improve safety, those things. Here are all the decision criteria. And then put the alternatives along the top. And it's our intention to show up to the workshop next week with this table fully filled out. And the hope of this is that ours aren't, when they're in color, it's a little easier to see, but you'll end up with one alternative will have a lot of green dots and one alternative will have a lot of red triangles. And it becomes very clear very quickly what's the preferred alternative. So it's a little bit bold to show up to this workshop and say, here's staff's preferred alternative. Do you concur or not concur? But hopefully that will direct the conversation towards, is this truly the preferred alternative, or did we get something wrong?
I'll tell you my problem with this is
okay.
If you have one side that is lobbying people very heavily, then you're going to see all the positive comments in that column.
Well, we're hoping that they're, and that's one thing we've come to you today with, are these criteria, are they subjective or are they quantifiable? And if it's a quantifiable criteria, for example, one of them is minimizing the number of conflict points. some alternatives will have more conflict points than others.
You know, I think what you're saying is this is something that staff is going to look at and come up with what's the best alternative. It's not something that's going out to the general public to get their opinions, what they think will be the best alternative. Is that correct?
That's correct. I do expect people to come up and comment on it, because some of these aren't as quantifiable as some of them. For example, public familiarity. You could argue one way or the other which one is the most familiar to the public. So there will be some that I think folks are going to come up and argue with us, did we rank it correctly? But I think a lot of them are clear. This one has more design exceptions than this one, and so it ranks higher.
Almost like one of those where you put up maps on the wall and people go up and they put their dots on the ones they like.
Yeah, almost.
The difference with this one, Aaron Brewster, Community Development Director, is this will be filled out ahead of time by staff with, you know, engineering criteria looked at. It's not done in a vacuum. It's not done by the public. This is done with, you know, professional judgment put into it to see which would the preferred alternative would be. Right today we've got in this criteria from the application, the HSIP application, a lot of the criteria from that application are on this criteria for evaluation. We want to find out what's the best alternative that is going to be the most successful to apply for. So this will be filled out, and this will help us focus our discussion to either the alternative that is preferred and or modifications to that one that are included on the list. The list isn't filled out today because we wanted to do it independently of the alternatives. We don't want to look like we're pre-selecting, like I said, putting the dots on the map where we want them. We want to establish that criteria so that the preferred alternative will come out of the process.
Who is going to fill it out and when?
Staff will fill this out immediately after we get direction from the board in preparation of next week's workshop.
I'm not so opposed to it then, that staff is going to, at the staff level, you're going to review it, because you know, it's nice to know how the public feels, but we pretty much heard that last time, and there are 20 different positions on what is the best alternative.
We're trying to give everybody equal consideration, and that's what the purpose of this criteria is to equally evaluate all the options that were presented to see which one rises to the top.
And the cost associated with those alternatives in the end.
Yeah, cost is one of the criteria.
Right.
Rebecca, I had one question for you, if I may. In regards to ACTC, what was the outcome in regards to improved site distance versus improved horizontal and vertical alignment? There's some discussion about that, I thought.
At the ACTC?
Right.
I wasn't there for that meeting. Ryan was there.
I thought we had public there that were more concerned about the improved site distance. I don't know. I'm just trying to remember what it was at the meeting.
Then improved horizontal and vertical alignment.
Right.
Well, those are the two countermeasures that are most applicable. The countermeasures are you fill out the HSIP application using certain countermeasures. Those are the two that are most applicable to this. So we're going to rank them based on how are they going to work out with the HSIP countermeasures. That's one of them. One of them is also the ultimate of the HSIP application is you calculate a benefit-cost ratio, and it's based on the countermeasures and the costs. And so which alternative is going to have the best benefit-cost ratio is going to be a big ranking criteria. So we're really trying to come up with quantifiable things that aren't so much of an opinion.
Towards the middle where you say accommodate large trucks, you're taking in all vehicles that are carrying heavier weights like horse trailers and things like that.
Yeah.
And that comment, I believe, is specific to STAA trucks. If we don't want to put in an intersection improvement, that would prohibit future utilization of that intersection by STAA-sized truck, which is a length.
That's like the issue they have up at Lowe's. Some of these, not just big trucks, but like interstate haulers that have a little bit longer trucks, they have an issue going to certain places in the county, and we're trying to make sure that we can alleviate that thing in Shenandoah Road as far as in the future at some point in time. Maybe they'll get in and out servicing those wineries and stuff up there.
Accommodating large trucks is a good criteria to have in there, but I would think you would also want to have something to accommodate vehicles with large loads, weight-wise, because if you're pulling a gooseneck with 14 or 15 cows in there, you're going to have a lot of weight on that vehicle.
Well, the E16 used to be quite a bit of activity for logging trucks coming down, and still probably is.
Those wouldn't really qualify as large trucks lengthwise, the logging trucks, would they?
They're standard truck, correct.
They're 80 feet.
So you're talking like somebody hauling into Walmart or Lowe's with those big old long interstate type trailers.
Yeah, longer trailer, longer tractor.
There's an issue where it would be more weight than length of the vehicle.
The weight would come into what pavement section is selected for the preferred alternative. And for that, instead of picking a lighter pavement section, we'll pick a heavier pavement section and use that to estimate the costs.
I'm also thinking, too, coming down that hill, depending on the configuration, some people would take a lot longer span to slow down, so that might be more a factor. Just notice a lot earlier that the intersection has changed and that they're going to have to negotiate it a little bit differently. Any other board comments? Can I ask for public comment at this time? Becca? Got some.
John Guthrie, I'm one of the ones who drive that section.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I conducted my own little workshop yesterday. I noticed with the improvements that you've placed there recently that there's been nothing but vandalism to them in the way of people hitting them and cutting them off and everything. But the little side drop road, this configuration I came up with eliminates all of that. It's down on the structure where it's flat, so you don't have to worry about that hill. That little side street that drops down, that's done away with. And since Plymouth has already decided, I guess, to put a roundabout Main Street 49, this is just something I came up with, which we would call an eggabout because it's on a Y rather than a perpendicular intersection. But by doing that, you don't impede really the flow, because once you're in the roundabout, you have the right-of-way. It's just the people entering the roundabout that have to yield to that traffic. Now, the drawing that I put here is just conceptual. It's not taken to any scale. But the general idea is that you can free flow in any direction. Whether you're coming down from Fiddletown, you want to go to Shenandoah Valley, you just make the roundabout, the U, and then head back up to Shenandoah Valley. Coming back from Shenandoah Valley to go to Fiddletown, you enter the roundabout and go back over to Fiddletown. It's basically a simple design, but like I say, it will make more sense if Plymouth does go ahead and put in the roundabout at 49 and Main Street. People will already be aware of the concept when they reach this point. And like I said, this is all down on the flat section. It's not using that hillside that everybody, comes down. It's right before that. And then something else I wanted to mention, that Burke Drive West has effectively been cut off from making a left-hand turn there. It's not Burke Drive where everybody enters and exits, but it curves on around, goes through the ranch, and then comes back out. And you put a solid white line there in the dividers. And on Burke Drive West, which is a private road, but like I said.
Mr. Guthrie?
Yes.
Burke Drive West, currently it doesn't exist, or if it is, it's a dirt road?
It's a dirt private road. It runs through the Terra del Oro vineyard there, and it comes out on the flat area there. Yeah, it's all, before you go up the hill. Then once you go up the hill is where everybody goes in and out of Burke Ranch. But this is part of the subdivision map.
Yeah, it's almost a future road, basically.
And then that development did happen. They changed that development agreement, became the vineyard.
Probably dedicated easement.
If I recall correctly, I don't know if it was Mr. Bruce Torrey that brought it up, but I think they one issue may have been cost, but the other issue was it's not a flat area. And roundabouts are preferred on a very flat area.
Yeah, this would be the flat area. Before you go up the hill to Fiddletown, That's where you come down to Fiddletown. Shenandoah Road is on that bottom level.
Would you have the decline coming down from Fiddletown?
Always.
And the roundabout would be right at the base of it, though?
It would start at that base. You would split off. That's where you yield to traffic that's going out to Shenandoah Valley. Then, like I say, it does something that I listen to the radio all the time, and when you give your report, I appreciate that. But it is true. It's about speed. It really is. And because I think the way it was years ago, why it was very dangerous, is probably better because people used to wait. When they made the right-hand turn lane, it does enter some confusion with people that are maybe tourists or not familiar with the area. But this basically eliminates all those problems because it's just a free flow of traffic, and it's up above is the 2013 roundabout from the driver handbook. So any licensed driver in California should be familiar with the concept, or is, you know, required to pass their exam. Like I say, it's a simple design. It's not to scale, but the idea being that this is before you go up the hill. You know, like I say, it's in the flat section, so it doesn't really require much grading. It's just a matter of lining up the legs and the divides. And something else, you're talking about the longer wheelbase trucks or semis. I've noticed, too, over at Lowe's that they made those roll-up curbs, and there's a pavement issue there, and they do just go basically straight across it. The tires go up in the back and over. So you probably would be faced with that no matter where you put a roundabout in Amador County.
You know, we're having a workshop a week from today.
Yeah, I actually had this all set up for that, but then we saw it on the agenda today, and I wasn't sure, and I wanted to get it to you before that date anyway so we could look at it first. But like I say, it makes everybody on an even playing field as far as somebody says, oh, I don't want to stop here, or somebody wants to yield, or this or that. Everybody's equal here because you have to yield by law before you enter the roundabout, or in this case, I call it an eggabout because it's a Y. But like I say, conceptually, I think it's a simple thing and it would work. I know that they've tried several things there, and like I say, everybody's going to eventually have a problem. But I don't like seeing what's been going on with the pilgrims. I call them pilgrims because of new arrival, but the road markers being, cut off at the ankles all the time and everything else. But that would eliminate all this because these are solid structures, and if somebody does turn wide in a larger truck, it's not going to do any damage. They just turn wider over that center median, and on they go. And I think that would accommodate future traffic. And like I say, it works in concert essentially with what Plymouth is eventually going to do, I guess, with the roundabout Main Street 49. And if this is out by itself, it might be a little problematic. But if there's those two together, then I think people are already cushioned, for what they're driving and what they see. And if it's properly marked, it shouldn't be a problem. Also, when you get to this point, you reduce speed anyways for that curve going out to Shenandoah Valley, where you're supposed to. And then it's maybe a quarter of a mile at that point. It's a reduced speed again before you get to Rory's Towing. And so it's a very short distance, so people aren't going to be accelerating up to 55. Once you hit that yield, you're going to see 25, and you're 25 already, miles per hour there. And then once you get through this, it's back to 55. But like I say, I just wanted to present it to you. I'm sorry I didn't get it to you earlier, but I do drive it all the time because I live in the subdivision there. And I've seen many of things go on there where people come out of Shenandoah Valley a little too fast and go over the double yellow. And right now when somebody's coming the other way and you have what I call pilgrims, so lane markers, you have the choice of hitting those or you go head on with somebody, which pilgrims will be first, I imagine. But this would eliminate all that because this takes away the possibility of a head-on collision or near head-on. It doesn't take away possibly T-bone, but your speeds are going to be so reduced, it's going to be minimal. It won't be like somebody going 45 or 90 miles per hour impact. This will be a whole lot less.
That's why on the alternative evaluation comparison they put confusion and speed because those were some of the main issues noted in the previous discussion we had.
Right. Yeah, when you said that, we were listening to the radio when you gave your report there, and that's why I appreciate it. It is really speed is the problem. But this really does control the speed, and it puts everybody at equal advantage or disadvantage because everybody has to yield entering the roundabout, And like I say, the speed prior to this is only 25 anyways.
They don't have to yield at a roundabout. The reason I say that is because I travel up through Minden once in a while, and sometimes I wonder why they put that in because some people just don't know how to use a roundabout.
Right.
if the sign says yield, they tend to just ignore it and drive right through it.
Yeah, you have to drive with caution always. But anyways, I just, like I say, because I know that the county has tried to do a few things there, there are some neighbors that have been injured down there. And like I say, this, I just decided I'd draw this up and bring it in, submit it. And, of course, a traffic engineer might have a whole different view of this anyways. But,
Mr. Crabtree, would this...
Guthrie.
Oh, Mr. Guthrie, I'm sorry. John, right?
Yes.
Okay. Would this be at the same place where the same intersection is now, or would this be below it?
Below it. It your comes up to the base
below
of the...
It. It's in that long...
How far down?
Just right there where Burke Drive West comes in, the private road. But that section is all pretty much flat all through there. And then, of course, Shenandoah Valley that goes off is relatively flat, too. So it really reduces the amount of grading that would have to be done or make any changes. Like I say, with this, I still believe because of the reduced speeds, that's going to be your safest bet.
Is Burke Drive West, is that where that gate is right now?
Right. Okay. It's a dirt road. It's a private road. They changed the development plan. One time, there was going to be another collector, Red Star Boulevard, that ran through that property, and then you'd have less traffic there anyways. But the development agreement was changed, so keeping that in mind, that's why we come up with something different now.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Guthrie.
Okay, and the workshop is still going to be on for next week.
Yes.
Okay.
9 a.m. on June 4th.
Okay. Thank you.
I better look at my board clerk, yes?
Right.
Okay. Any other comments?
Yeah, I just have one comment. I know there's a lot of people all that are up in the Fiddletown, Shenandoah area that were pretty adamantly opposed to roundabouts. You know, they didn't like the one that Fiddletown or Plymouth was proposing. So I think that might be something that'd be, as far as trying to get public support for it, might be pretty tough.
Well, it's also going to be a cost issue for the county. What can we afford and what can we not afford?
True.
I don't think public works is flowing with money right now. And the grant is for, 1.5? 1.5. So if we exceed that, I don't know where it's going to come from the county side. Maybe pull $500,000 out of contingency, right, Chuck? About all we have in there. So, all right, as far as the alternative evaluation comparison, does that... pass the muster with the board?
Generally, I had a couple questions on some of the items that were there. There's a couple of categories, impact to existing utilities and oak tree removal impacts. Is that something that's in there because of the HCIP? Is it part of their criteria?
No, those are just things that could potentially cause some environmental mitigation costs. The oak tree, the county's oak tree mitigation plan is a little expensive. And then impacts to utilities, those are also really expensive items to start bringing into a cost estimate.
I think that's something that'd probably shake out in the wash as far as what you're looking at as far as your designs. I don't know if I look at that as far as the criteria of what's the best intersection.
It could be one factor. In there was a comment about coming in and just blitzing this intersection and how somebody didn't want to see that happen, wanted to see the intersection remain as landscaped as possible. We can replace the grasses that we take out, but oak trees take a much longer time to replace.
The one comment was the gateway, remember?
Yeah.
Rebecca, I wanted to ask you a question. Do the power lines cross the road right there at that intersection?
I did not see overhead, but I was not looking specifically for them, so I'm going back out today to see what I can find.
I was curious because if there's talk about big rigs or special special permitted rigs going that way, then we should definitely look at that.
Definitely.
Some of the designs that were presented to us are longer. Along the highway, stretch of highway. So, would that increase your environmental studies that you have to do?
No, generally, it's just the footprint of the area. It's kind of a wash on the cost. But Supervisor Onetto, we met with Supervisor Plas and Supervisor Onetto last week, and they brought up the fact that the city's wastewater, or the city's drinking water treatment plant is right up Fiddletown Road. So if we lower that piece of Fiddletown Road, we're potentially running into water lines. So there have been, some of the alternatives have been asking us to reduce that hump that's up there by the water treatment plants. But if we do that, now we're going to have to add in an additional underground utility cost. That's why that was added as a criteria.
AWA feeds that with a pipeline.
Yeah, I think what we're looking at was the AWA pipeline comes cross-country.
Right.
I don't think that'd be a problem, but I'm wondering about what we're wondering about is the feeder line that goes from the tank down the city of Plymouth. You know, is it off on the shoulder of the road, or out in, you know, the, where the grapes are, or is that thing going, you know, right down Fiddletown Road?
It runs inside the fence line of Teradoro, so. It's
okay, well, appreciate that, Mr. Guthrie.
Any other comments on this, or conceptually, does the board approve of it?
I think I'm conceptually, I'm okay with it. Yeah,
I'm okay with it.
All right, just let's just note that. Consensus of the board is that the document looks good. So. We're back on the accommodating the large trucks, but as far as weight, that's something that the road should already have in consideration, right? So there's no need to specifically address that point then?
Correct.
Thickness of pavement.
We'll make sure we have a nice thick pavement section.
Yeah, maybe some shoulders. If it's an 80-foot truck and trailer, they're going to need, well, log trucks do it, but they might cheat right now. But you want a little more shoulder just in case they do cheat.
Yeah, the geometrics of the intersection will be set up so there's pavement for those trucks to go wherever they need to go.
Okay. All right. You have your direction. Thank you.
See you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Everybody's going to leave now, so we won't have anybody here. So. All right. That's all right. Item 9, County Medical Services Program discussion and possible action relative to a recent meeting regarding the subject plan. The plan is coming out of the governor's office, the administration, and because of that, at our County Medical Services Program meeting last week, Lee Kemper, our former executive director, now our director of planning, and changed his name now. He's more of a consultant position, but he is not very happy with the administration, as a lot of counties are not. Their basic plan that they have is just like they did with AB 109, saying that all of this money is going to come in, and we're going to be running most of these programs and taking care of the indigent population, so you won't need any money. So their plan is to take 2013-14, $300 million, 2014-15, $900 million, and 2015-16, $1.3 billion, and redirect it to a number of different areas, CalWORKS program, and let's see my notes here. CalWORKS program, managed care, in-home supportive services. So they want to redirect all that money. The problem is that it was pretty well laid out in a template letter and resolution that Lee Kemper put together that, as he said, once that money is gone, we will never see it again. What the governor and the administration want to do is implement their program when the ACA or Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, comes into play. They want to start taking the money right at the onset and then do the calculations later to see if they're actually, if counties actually are being made whole. And if they're not, then they will reimburse them. That seems very backwards to counties, especially knowing that once this money is basically raided by the state, we won't see it again. Karen Lang with Peterson Consulting at our meeting said that the governor's not in a spending mood now. The legislature is. but there's not enough money in the budget to fund everything. That's probably no surprise in Sacramento. The governor does want to put the $500 million generated by AB 32 into the general fund, which that's not where it was supposed to go. Mike Welkening, who's the undersecretary of the California Health and Human Services Agency, said the governor is trying to shift dollars to education and health care, in the governor's view, is their responsibility now, so all the funds should be shifted to the state. That's not quite the case. As the letters point out, counties are still going to have a significant role in dealing with health care in the counties. Public health is really not even addressed in the governor's proposal. So what we're afraid of is there's not going to be enough money. And the other thing is, for about the last 10 years, health, public health, and other areas in the counties have just been neglected, and not enough money has been going into the pot. The realignment dollars are shrinking, and the way it's set up, the governor wants to take most of the realignment dollars, too. So the CMSP board took action opposing the administration's take of the health care dollars and against the administration taking realignment dollars. If you refer to the couple of the documents you received, the mechanisms for determining county savings and maintaining county safety net, that is the administration's document and their view of why counties will not need as much money. The other document, the role of the health care safety net in the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, that's a draft that CSAC will be releasing regarding health care. And they have addressed all of the areas, those counties with public health hospitals, with those counties that are CMSP counties, and payer and clinic counties. So there's many different areas, but CSAC has pretty much the same view, which is refreshing to see from CSAC. They've been trying to get along with the governor, but you know, at some point you gotta cut and go your own way, and they're trying to do what's best, they feel, for all counties within the framework of the new health care and programs and the way they're being implemented under the Affordable Care Act. So in your packet, there's a sample resolution that we are being requested to send, along with a sample letter to President Pro Tempore Daryl Steinberg and Speaker of the Assembly John Perez. If the governor is successful, this is going to really affect all counties. Amador County specifically will lose almost $400,000 the first year. Those are the 1991 health realignment May revision proposal estimate impacts and prorated reductions. In 14-15, we're projected to lose about $1.15 million, $1.16 million, and in 15-16, we're projected to lose about close to $1.7 million. So big areas that we need to look at. Our main concern from the CMSP board is that why not wait? We have 3 years of guaranteed funding coming from the federal government, at least, and I think CSAC points this out in their draft that I gave you, at least wait until the third year to consider anything and find out where the deficiencies will be, find out where the excesses will be in funding. The state doesn't want to look at it like that. They want to solve their budget problems, much as they did with AB 109 on the backs of counties again.
I didn't see a draft resolution in this packet.
The what?
The resolution. I didn't see one. Is there one in there?
Didn't have a resolution in your packet. I thought Teresa put that in all of them, but
is that it in yours?
It was another letter from draft letter from CSAC, and then the letter under your signature.
I can
draft.
Well, it won't take long to read it. Whereas is this county participates in the CMSP, which provides health program to low-income uninsured adults. Whereas since 83, the low-income uninsured populations of this county and other small and rural urban counties participating in CMSP have benefited from the provisions of reliable health care coverage. Whereas maintaining and strengthening the health care safety net of this county and other CMSP counties is important for three reasons, and this almost exactly mimics the CSAC letter, to assure continued provision of health care services to low-income uninsured populations following implementation of the federal ACA, two, to promote development and strength of the health care and behavioral health provider networks needed for delivery of health care services to safety net populations, and three, to promote community health through continued support of essential public health infrastructure. Whereas this county seeks to assure the county health realignment funding for the county public health services is protected to meet essential public health responsibilities of this county and other CMSP counties. And then be it resolved that our board takes the following positions regarding the governor's proposed redirection of county health realignment funds to the state beginning in 2013-14. County opposes the governor's proposed redirection of county health realignment funds to the state for 13-14 and 14-15. During these years, no county health realignment funds payable to this county or other CMSP counties shall be paid by these counties to the state. Two, for 13-14 and 14-15, no county health realignment funds payable to the CMSP governing board shall be paid by the CMSP governing board to the state. Three, for 15-16 and each fiscal year thereafter, the contribution of county health realignment funds to the state by this county and any other CMSP county shall be limited to the amounts these counties would otherwise pay to participate in CMSP pursuant to Welfare and Institutions Code 16809. And it says for this county, this amount is blank, so we would need to fill in the blank there. No other county health realignment funds or any other funds shall be paid to the state from the county or any other CMSP county. And for 15-16 and each year thereafter, the CMSP governing board shall retain sufficient county health realignment funds to provide health benefit coverage to remaining low-income uninsured populations in this county and other CMSP counties and provide for needed reinvestment in the health care, behavioral health, and public health infrastructures in this county and other CMSP counties. That's really one of the biggest ones because the unknown is future uninsured populations. And the other unknown is there's a segment of the population out there that may not meet indigent level status. They'll be slightly above it, so they will fall in that gap where the Affordable Care Act basically loses them, and the county will have responsibility still for their health needs.
Yeah, talked about, what, like 3 to 4 million people, I think it was? That would.
Yeah, I think they said, I don't know if it was that high. I think somewhere in my documentation there's a...
I saw it, the ones that are not going to be uninsured under the Affordable Health Care Act. It talked about... after 2014, estimates from the ECB, UCLA modeling, it's a model, of course, find that after 5 years of implementation, an estimated 3 to 4 million people in California will remain uninsured. So that would be big dollars.
That's where, just entering the CMSP population, I think you're talking about an additional 150,000 people for small rural counties that are going to need insurance. And another big thing in this is under the state proposal, the state can rebase every year and take more dollars. So that's a big factor. I mean, they can come in and basically set the level that they want that's going to give the most money to the state of California and not to counties. So what they're asking for is doctors and providers out there really need to start educating patients as to which direction they're going to need to go for services. The other thing that Lee Kemper brought up is if the administration repurposes those ACA dollars, they're not subject to Prop 98. So that's basically a $2.5 or $3 billion windfall to the state of California that they can do with whatever they want to do. Little discussion of public health, as I said, and the state's formula just creates a mechanism to take more county dollars. Fortunately, we've been through AB 109, so counties have got a good education on how the state wants to treat us. Supervisor?
Yes, we have a draft letter of county opposition in our packet. That's probably been superseded by the latest letter we have. As far as to Honorable Daryl Steinberg?
Yeah, that's the draft letter that's been put together. And also, what's been asked is that we send the draft letter and the resolution.
Well, what I'm asking is we have a draft letter in our packet, and we have a draft letter received this morning.
Right.
The draft letter received this morning is when we're looking at sending.
The draft letter you received this morning is the one to Steinberg and Perez?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, because there's also a draft letter of county opposition in our packet addressed to them also. I just want to make sure if we're sending a letter, we're sending one. The latest letter is the one we're going to be sending.
Right, the one with the addresses. I think Teresa typed that up on Friday and inserted Amador County in there.
It looks like a pretty good letter, though.
It's a really good letter. I think that, you know, as we all know, CSAC Ledge Conference starts tomorrow and goes through Thursday. I think this is going to be a talk about this when we're down there.
Oh,
it's going to be a lot button issue, especially for, you know, even some of the bigger counties. It's going to be a huge hit in county hospitals.
Yep. If you're down in Sacramento,
Health and Human Services.
Health and Human Services Committee meeting should be a good one. Lee Kemper will be there, I know, to talk about these. But the other thing I've got the language that came out of the legislative hearing, subcommittee hearing, budget subcommittee hearing on this, and it's a lot of information for them to absorb, for legislators to absorb. But the three big questions that came out, the subcommittee requested the Department of Healthcare Services to respond to the following: one, please provide an overview of this proposal. Two, what is the timeline for finalizing the details of this mechanism? And basically, it has to be done by about July. And three, what is the basis of the $300 million in county savings on indigent care? And that's coming out of just 13-14 that they're saying there's going to be those savings. Now, our view is just pretty simple. The state should just not make this grab on money until they can justify that counties have that kind of savings. And even then, as the resolution stated, there are a lot of unmet needs in counties. Basically, realignment funding has been going down in the last 10 years, not going up. And that's what the state is basing their projections on, is a time period where you've had basically a static period where there's been no increase in realignment funding over the last 10 years. So what we're being asked is to, what you're being asked for is to approve the letter and the resolution to be sent off to these gentlemen as well as all of those that are listed under the CC.
There's no public comment. I'd make a motion that we go ahead and send the resolution and the letter under the chairman's signature.
I'll second that, but I think our CAO is going to come back with a complete report from the Ledge Conference on CMPs.
Could I ask under the motion, Supervisor Boitano, that you include our own legislators there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Because all he lists is local stakeholders determined by county, so I would.
Yeah.
And if you can think of anyone else, but also I think we should.
And the governor himself. Hmm? And the governor himself.
It's on there, Honorable Jerry Brown, but also CSAC and RCRC.
Yeah. You know, I'm just under a comment. I'd like to make a comment. Part of the problem I see is rather than trying to dig out more money from hook and crook for the CalFresh and CalWorks and all that, I think what government should be looking at doing is figure out ways to get the economy going and more jobs so you'd lessen your costs by having people working off welfare. Rather than trying to say, hey, how are we going to make more funding for those people that are on welfare and CalWorks and CalFresh? And I understand people need food, but I think there's a lot of people, if there's a decent job out there, they'd probably rather work, well, I'd hope, rather work than get it for free.
There's work, but
the problem is you
go down to the Capitol, and the reason why our legislators are being so impacted to give money to IHSS is because you can't even walk through the halls half the time because when they have rallies, there are so many purple shirts down there with IHSS concerns that they're impacting our legislators. The other thing that's a little distressing is that if we knew the state was going to redirect this money, if we knew the state was going to live up to their promises of making counties whole, if we knew the state was going to use the money appropriately instead of transferring it, as in the greenhouse gas money coming in, putting it in areas like the general fund where it just goes into the black hole, we have to look at, and our CAO has to look at every penny in our budget to try and balance our budget, and then you get the state having all of this revenue coming in, and it's like party time for them. They just see it and want to put it in places where there's no intention that it should have ever gone.
Well, I mean, we're mandated by law to have a balanced budget, but it's not the same game for the legislature.
This is a huge issue, and there's still a thought out there that may just end up in one big lawsuit, and if that happens, it's really going to be a mess statewide because of the first county or two that file lawsuits, that's going to open the floodgates, and pretty much it's going to draw everybody into the picture, including our county.
Vote.
Yep. We had motion by Supervisor Boitano, second by Supervisor Novelli, to send the letter with the modifications and the resolution. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries 401. Let's handle the minutes quickly before we take a break before our 10:30 public hearing.
It was interesting to see that we have a new chairman.
I'm a chairman again.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
The chairman again?
Yeah.
The vice chairman.
Page one, Chairman Boitano reported the following issues. And they have you as vice chairman up top.
Yeah.
Which is okay.
That's all right. I'm used to being demoted. My wife did it all the time. So.
And then on the second page, Chairman Boitano led the board in public pledge of allegiance. And that was about...
All right. Now I'm going a little bit too far.
I got some changes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Where was your changes?
Page three, where it says community development... block grants. I also mentioned there not only for the water tanks, but I mentioned to help with some of our hydrant systems up country where when you open up the hydrant, they deplete the water out of the homes, and that's not in there. And then on page five, where it says further discussions ensured, the board requesting Cochran contact Ballard Acoustics Consultants. I also stated in there when we had the mine before us that I told Mr. Cochran that if we do contract out and also our subcontractors, we're going to try to do everything possible to get locals involved. And I believe that's it, Mr. Chairman, for my changes.
I had a few more changes, too.
Minor, major?
Center, probably went major. Other than the mess-up or the mistakes or choose chairman who's vice chairman, should be page three, should be Congressman McClintock. not Assemblyman. And also, there's a couple minor ones, but there was some probably substantial changes on page 7, where we have a lot of stuff in there from 2012, and that should probably be 2013. All the dates there are wrong. So, I mean, top of the page, confidential minutes, it has August 28, 2012, and September 11, 2012. I'm not sure what should be in there, but I'm sure it should be changed. And the same with the motion, the dates are wrong in that, too. And as far as adjournment, that's also wrong. So, I like those corrections. I'm okay with the minutes.
Okay. Any further changes? Can I have a motion?
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes with changes.
Second.
Moved and seconded to approve the minutes with changes. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries 4-0-1. Board will take a couple-minute break. Give us five to 10 minutes, and we'll come back into session.